Welcome, and I really mean welcome, to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And we're pretty excited because we've just come back from New Hampshire, where we saw an exciting week, 10 days of politics. It's great to get out and actually be in the scrum. Is that not true, Ken?
It's true. As I would put it, I came, I saw, I conquered.
You conquered. Oh, that's so nice.
Thank you very much.
That's like a New Hampshire joke.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Moving right along. Yeah. What did you think of the results of the New Hampshire primary?
Well, the headline, of course, is Mitt Romney, but that's not really the headline. The headline is
Bank Capital.
Well, that's another headline. We'll get to that in a second. The headline did say Mitt Romney won with nearly 40% of the vote, and that is what he was expected to do all along.
No, not all along. It was what he was expected to do long ago.
That's right.
Then it got closer, or it appeared to be getting closer.
And then we always talk about the expectation game, because, you know, we know that Lyndon Johnson and Ed Muskie won New Hampshire, but not by the margin they wanted to. And so who was the real winner, who was not? But the real story is, there are two stories. One, Ron Paul is more serious than I would have imagined. And I don't know if he's going to get 25% in a six-person field or 25% in a two-person field.
Or both.
Well, yes, but 25% in a six-person field is far more impressive.
Absolutely. It really makes him look like number two.
Well, he was number two because
exactly.
I looked at the standings and he finished at number two. And
he was finished right below number one.
Hence the term number two.
And, well ahead of number three.
And we always said that Ron Paul does very well in caucus states because of the organizing. But if he can do this well in primary states too, he's never willing to go away quietly, and he was never going to go away soon. Even with minuscule support in 2008, he lasted until mid-June, but he just seems to be growing and growing.
All right, I'm going to disagree, and I'm glad once in a while we can disagree on the podcast and still be friends. But I think that Ron Paul has both arrived and is done.
You think he peaked?
But he will not go away. Okay,
well,
he has arrived and he is done. This is the last time he's going to have this kind of impact, even though I don't think he's going to go away.
Well,
I think he's going to continue.
Why should he go away?
But he will, unless he is willing to make himself a torpedo against Mitt Romney, the way Newt Gingrich did for several days, maybe will not continue to do
that. I don't think he's like that.
I don't think he is either, and I don't think he has a personal animus. And I think he wants to be an advocate for a cause more than he wants to be president of the United States.
Perhaps.
As he has admitted himself, he doesn't really see himself in the White House. But while he had special circumstances that helped him do well in Iowa, a caucus, as you said, in New Hampshire he had special circumstances that helped him do well, which is that he's been campaigning there for a long, long time.
As long as Mitt Romney, right.
And it is a libertarian part of the Republican Party overall.
And independents vote in New Hampshire,
and
many of them voted for him.
40% of the people in the state call themselves independents, and in the exit polls in this Tuesday vote, half, 49%, identified themselves as something other than Republicans. Lots of them voted for Ron Paul.
Why not? He's against the war. He's been against the war from the beginning. He's for the constitutional liberties that many Republicans are, shall we say, questionable about.
And he's getting about one vote in five, maybe a little better than that. So where does he go from here? He's not going to do that well in South Carolina. It's not his natural constituency.
We don't have to predict that, though. We don't need to predict it.
And he's
Let's
not going
surprised.
To do very well in Florida because he can't really compete there in terms of money, and
Nobody.
So he's probably going to move on. You need $10 million to be legitimate in Florida, and he's not going to have that kind of money, so we don't expect him to do much more than 20%.
But he could do Barack Obama's strategy against Hillary Clinton. Look at those caucus states where a lot of those surprise delegates may show up, the Nevadas of the world, things like that.
So he has arrived. He is done as far as having somebody who has a serious shot at knocking off the front runner or becoming the nominee. But he's not going away. He's going to stick around for those low cost, small payoff caucus situations you just described, and for the chance to go to Tampa in August and be able to say, I'm the last alternative to Mitt Romney. All the other candidates fell by the wayside. I'm still here. I've got who knows what percentage of the delegates. It probably won't be a huge percentage. But on the other hand, it'll probably be 20% or more across the board.
It won't be a huge percentage because after April 1st, every delegation is winner take all again. We're back to that again.
Although with some of those caucus states, he could still do well.
Caucus states.
So he gets there. He's not going to have a huge proportion of the delegates, but they're going to be noisy and they're going to be active.
Right. And the other headline I felt coming away from New Hampshire is John Huntsman. John Huntsman obviously tried to emulate the famous John McCain, I'm going to bypass Iowa, go into New Hampshire, move into New Hampshire, make the case that this is where my candidacy rises or falls. And it didn't rise. A third place, he could talk about a ticket to ride all he wants. But I mean, look, we saw when Bill Clinton lost in New Hampshire in 1992 and he was the comeback kid, that spin worked. John Huntsman's spin of, we have a ticket to ride, we're going to South Carolina, that didn't work for me at all. To throw all his marbles into the New Hampshire basket and still come away with 16% of the vote and finish a third place, to me, that was a big defeat.
It was not a close second.
No.
There was a period of time in the last hours, the last days, when it appeared he might finish second. If he could have finished second, beaten Ron Paul with all of Ron Paul's assets, or at least contested for that position of number two and been a little closer than to number one. In other words, if you had like a 30-20-20 kind of a split, but a 40, roughly,
right,
with
25-16,
he's really not in the running. He may be technically in the top three, but it's meaningless because the rest of the candidates were just way, way far behind. And so he didn't really seem to have made much of this opportunity.
And part of the reason I thought it was such a defeat is that, Ron, you and I were both in New Hampshire. And when I heard after the Sunday debate, the Meet the Press debate, that he had finally taken off the gloves, he was really going after Mitt Romney, he was starting to make a strong case for his own candidacy. And a lot of people saying, you know, I'm thinking more and more about that John Huntsman guy. He seemed to impress me in the debate. And again, to not have anything to show for it on Tuesday, I think was a disappointment.
It's conceivable he might have come away from this experience and said on Tuesday night or on Wednesday, you know, I gave it my best shot. There really does not seem to be a path forward. I don't see where I finish even as high as third again. So I'm going to take my hat back out of the ring and see what I can do to serve the eventual nominee, whomever that might happen to be. But he didn't.
Now, you know how romantic I get about New Hampshire. Remember that day when you and I were both crying with Ed Muskie in the snow? And remember you and I were both paying for that microphone with Mr. Breen?
That's right.
And Ronald Reagan?
All those times.
For all the great stories that I've always come away with New Hampshire, I didn't feel it this time. And a part of it was, I think, the fact that Mitt Romney was thought for the longest time this was going to be his home turf, just as Iowa was not a big deal because of Tom Harkin running in 1992. But in fairness, it was only Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and John Huntsman who competed in New Hampshire. Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and of course Rick Perry, the remainder of the pack,
stepped back,
went straight to South Carolina.
Well, Newt came and campaigned some, and of course all of them, all three, Newt and the Ricks, were all there for the debates on Saturday night and Sunday morning.
Like Benny and the Jets?
Which was a lot like Benny and the Jets. And in these two debates, they were pretty aggressive. And they all went after Romney, and especially on Sunday morning in the NBC News debate. Well, Newt Gingrich had perhaps his feistiest moments of all, including when after Romney's very first remarks, Newt said,
But can we drop a little bit of the pious baloney?
And I'll be honest with you, pious baloney was one of my favorite popes.
Pius the First, Pius the Eleventh, I think, was famous, and then there was Pius Baloney.
And there was Pope Pius the Sailor Man.
Well, you know, a friend of mine just bought a car, gets really good gas mileage.
Is it a Pius?
It's a Pius.
Well, he must work for NPR.
Oh, that's baloney.
Well, first of all, the thought of Newt Gingrich calling somebody else pious is...
How about the word baloney suddenly being selectively applied to one speech in one of these debates? That was, can we cut the pious baloney? Wow. That was a moment.
It was a moment. And you wonder if it reminded me, actually, of Geraldine Ferraro resenting George H.W. Bush's
patronization
during the 1984 vice presidential debate. But it reminded me whether it was the thought of Newt Gingrich talking about anybody else's, you know,
hypocrisy,
piousosity.
Yeah. Yes, I think we saw a little piousosity there.
And it was interesting, too, that for all the criticisms conservatives have about Mitt Romney, and they're legitimate, they're about Romney care and the flip-flops on abortion and gay rights and things like that.
And the general plasticity and phoniness.
Right. Well, right.
And the lack of common touch, the walking into a grocery store and walking up to somebody in the middle of an aisle and saying to them, so, you shopping here? I mean, the man does not seem to have what you would call...
It reminds me of the George H.W. Bush scanner in the supermarket in 92 in New Hampshire.
And these moments are all, they're all artificial, and it's unfair to judge anyone on the basis of this, but it would be better for him as a candidate if he had just one-tenth of, let's say, Bill Clinton's ability to walk up to somebody and chummy and talk and just sort
Mike
of...
Huckabee. Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee, even. The kind of chumminess.
Oh, absolutely. Mike Huckabee seemed the most genuine meet the guy in an elevator and just strike up a conversation candidate I've ever met.
But Santorum, though, will not go after him on Bain. I mean, first of all, this is the DNC Obama White House argument against Mitt Romney that you're going to see all fall, that Bain was a, as to quote Rick Perry, he was not a venture capitalist, he was a vulture capitalist.
Now, Perry's been getting some
good lines.
That's a good line. I don't know if he's making them up himself.
He could double his support in New Hampshire.
Well, I mean, consider, though, but there was the vulture, not venture capitalist line, and then there was the one after Mitt Romney had rather unconvincingly claimed to have worried about getting a pink slip a couple of times.
There was also a third thing.
Well, then Rick Perry popped up and said, look, he's not worried about getting a pink slip. The only time he's ever worried about pink slips is having enough of them to hand out to all of his employees.
Wait, but there was a third thing, wasn't there?
From Perry?
Oh, yeah, the Energy Department.
Oh, I get that.
Thanks.
Yes. I get that.
Within the same day, and I like that. I mean, look, for whatever we talk about private equity firms, that's what they do. I mean, we could criticize capitalism until we're blue in the face.
Well, red might be appropriate.
That's right. Well, that's a Blue Man Group. I mean, the argument that Newt Gingrich is making, and even Jim DeMint, who is obviously no fan of
Mitt Romney,
he still says that, you know, we aren't kind of echoing the kind of argument you'll hear from the Democrats November.
Well, here's what it reminds me of, and maybe this is a stretch, but back in 1988, Al Gore tried to make a big argument against Mike Dukakis, who was then the front runner, guy from Massachusetts, what do you know, and winning the New Hampshire primary. Al Gore went after him about a guy named Willie Horton, who had gotten out of jail on a furlough and committed a rape and a murder. And Willie Horton was a controversy in Massachusetts most people in the country hadn't heard about yet. And Al Gore brought it up and said, this symbolized the kind of liberal who would let somebody like Willie Horton out of jail to commit these heinous crimes. And it seemed to stick a little bit. And all the Democrats gathered around Mike Dukakis and said, you know, Al, that's not a very nice argument for a Democrat to be making against a Democrat. So it went away in the primaries. And, of course, as soon as we got to the summer, a guy who didn't have those scruples named Lee Atwater got a hold of it, working for his boss, George H.W. Bush, and said, when I'm through with him, people are going to think Willie Horton is Mike Dukakis' running mate.
You know something? This is a political junkie moment here, and I don't mean to, but I read this not too long ago. Did you know that for all the attacks that Richard Nixon made against Helen Gahagan Douglas in the 1950 Senate race about her being the pink lady and her ties to communists, that first came out by a fellow Democrat against Douglas
in the
Democratic
primary.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's an excellent example. A little bit more remote in time, back before any of us would possibly have been born. But
it was yesterday.
But another good example of how an argument initially raised in the primaries and oftentimes stifled by a clucking from all of the other people in that party, not a good Democratic argument, not a good Republican argument, can sometimes reemerge. Not that the folks in the White House needed a whole lot of coaching to come up with Bain Capital, but if the kinds of things that are being said by Republicans, Perry, Gingrich, others, now, you know you're going to see all of those again in ads very shortly.
But you still can't convince Newt Gingrich or even any of the Romney opponents to say that's the reason we shouldn't be using it, because if you're going to stop him, and I've been getting tons of emails from the Gingrich folks, if you're going to stop him, you have to stop him by South Carolina, because that really may be the last chance. And we know historically what campaigns are like in South Carolina.
We do. They tend to be nastier than about any other state in the union. It seems there are no rules. And if you're going
John McCain with the having a black baby out of wedlock, when of course, I mean,
the child in the family pictures was an adopted child from Bangladesh.
Right. And in the 1980 primary, I think it was the Bush people who said that John Connolly was taking money from strip joints and gay groups. I mean, the history of South Carolina.
And only in South Carolina.
Yeah.
These are not arguments you hear in New Hampshire.
No.
Because presumably people would have more of a backlash against it.
And we have two more debates coming up before the primary. Romney had a couple of tough days in New Hampshire. It's going to be tougher going to South Carolina.
Here again, gloves are off, rules are different, and there's the sense of desperation. People cannot wait for Romney to fall down on his own. They're going to have to try to knock him down. We saw a little bit of that in the second debate, the Sunday morning debate up in New Hampshire, the Meet the Press debate with David Gregory. And I thought maybe they were starting to get on a roll, but then, again, they're so fearful of the damage they may do in the eyes of their party colleagues, that they don't want to be seen as turncoats in some way or another.
I don't think Gingrich is fearful of that.
But we don't know if Gingrich is going to stick with it or not. He seemed to have really gotten the thrust all the way in, and then he started to kind of pull the rapier back
out. The ads are going to be coming.
I know, the ads are out there, and the things that he has said are going to be eternalized on the internet and in the ads that the Democrats make.
And if Newt Gingrich really wanted to stop those ads, he would have stopped them. Which is, of course, his argument against Mitt Romney in Iowa when Mitt Romney says, I have no control.
I have
them.
No control. I can't even talk to that's my super PAC doing that. Well, now, in fact, there is truth in this, though, that at this point, the super PAC that's supporting Newt Gingrich, which is bankrolled by Sheldon Adelson, the casino owner from Las Vegas.
Led by Rick Tyler, his former press secretary.
And this is the group that's really doing the damage now by putting $5 million behind ads that otherwise might be out there on the internet, but that would not be seen in South Carolina households.
So, inevitable. I mean, Mitt Romney, the first non-incumbent Republican to win Iowa and New Hampshire.
If he wins South Carolina, I don't see how you deny him Florida. And if he wins all four of those, the field will be, in effect, winnowed, except for Ron Paul.
One thing that we should remind the listener about is that the last three presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all lost the New Hampshire primary en route to winning the presidency. So maybe winning New Hampshire wasn't a great thing for Mitt Romney. But speaking of Barack Obama,
he had a pretty good January so far.
Right? Yeah. Iowa, New Hampshire?
Yeah. He won the Iowa caucuses and he won the New Hampshire primary.
And Bill Keller of the New York Times is the latest person to talk about the option of, which is just such a silly idea, but it keeps coming up, that President Obama should give the Secretary of State position to Joe Biden when Hillary Clinton leaves sometime this year, and then award her with the running mate status at the convention in Charlotte.
Now, given that the administration has shown not the slightest interest in doing this.
They've said no. It's like Chris Christie. How many times do I have to say no before you listen to my no?
Why does this keep coming up, and why is it always being put forward by media from the state of New York? I put it to you, Ken Rudin.
Look, Bill Keller
is not a New Yorker by birth. He's a Californian.
No, that's not the point. The Bill Keller should know better. I understand the politicos say, let's do this fantasy, let's do that fantasy. But Bill Keller should know better.
And I think he does know better. But I think that people in New York talk about this so much that a New York-based media person has to, at some point or another, address it. They have to either say this would be a good idea, or they have to say this would not be a good idea, because it is such a conversation point in the city and state of New York. Now, here's where we could all be made to look silly. Down the road, at some point or another, for some reason or another, the polls show that Obama is seriously slipping. The economy is not improving. Maybe we take an unexpected downturn. Maybe we get into some sort of a fracas with Iran that isn't going very well. Some kind of new element changes the basic 50-50 dynamic we're in right now between Obama and Mitt Romney or some Republican. If that should happen, and if we slip into a situation where the Republican is clearly ahead and Obama is clearly behind before we get to the Charlotte convention late this summer, then I think this idea will come back. It will come back with a vengeance, and it may be necessary because polls show that Hillary Clinton would add a great deal more in November than Joe Biden does.
I'm not questioning what she might bring to the ticket. I'm saying it absolutely will not happen. The last elected vice president dumped from the ticket?
1944, they dumped Henry Wallace
That's
in favor
correct.
Of Harry Truman.
That's correct.
And FDR was forced to do this because people were coming to learn about his health. They didn't know he was going to die just a short time after he was inaugurated for his last term. But they knew his health wasn't that great. They were afraid Henry Wallace, whom they regarded as a socialist, many Democrats did in 1944 and with real reason, they didn't want him to be acceding to the presidency. So they forced FDR to replace him with Harry Truman, who, of course, did become president the very next year and did serve until 1953.
Okay, so he's not going to dump Joe Biden, but I suspect he might dump Bill Daley.
I think Bill Daley is in real trouble at the White House. In fact, I would go so far as to say that he's already out. He's virtually out.
Doesn't he have
he's
show,
gone.
Doesn't he have a show on Comedy Central? The Daily Show.
That would be the Daily Show. Bill Daley, the son of Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, the long-time mayor of Chicago, whose term in office was only exceeded by his son, Richard M. Daley, yeah. Who has recently left office and been replaced by Rahm Emanuel, who used to be chief of staff of the White House, became chief of staff at the White House a year ago, Bill Daley did, and he was supposed to be the answer to running the White House more like a business and communicating better with the business community. And how did that work out for them?
Well, here's the thing. Yes, he was brought in to talk to business and Wall Street.
Especially Wall Street.
But given the fact that the Obama campaign is going to be running against Republicans.
And running against Wall Street.
Absolutely. William Daley is not the guy you want to be running that effort.
Plus, let it be said that the promise of Mr. Daley, who was brought in about a year ago, was that he was going to be really effective at framing a message that put the president forward as a more competent leader and so on. And the negotiations with Congress, the negotiations with Republicans, the debt ceiling crisis last summer, all of these things, whether they can be laid at his doorstep or not, represented the opposite of what he was supposed to achieve in this job. And so really his departure has been inevitable all along. And he's now been succeeded by Jacob Jack Lew, who is a really rather popular figure within the administration, who previously was the director of the Office of Management and Budget. So bye-bye, Bill, and hello, Jack. And what kind of music do you want to go out on?
There's a Beatles song.
I can't remember the name of it.
No, it's
but it came to my mind earlier this week during the New Hampshire primary.
When Huntsman was saying, wait a second,
what was it he was saying?
She's got a ticket to ride. She's got a ticket to ride.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
While you still can, I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
She's got a ticket to ride. She's